Hello and welcome to the One Short Podcast, the Sports Gazette's official cricket podcast. As always, I'm Toby, joined by Ayush. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Toby?
Yeah, good, thanks. We've got a really exciting episode. First ever guest on this podcast. We're joined by Nick Friend from The Cricketer. How are you, Nick?
I'm good. I didn't know I was first. Sorry to let the side down.
No, definitely not, mate. It's gonna be an exciting episode. Should be a good one. But yeah, we're going to talk a lot about the Cricket World Cup, obviously, which is currently underway. England are taking on India at the moment in what should be quite an interesting game. England are starting to find their form over halfway through the tournament. It's a bit late. But I think we better start with the obvious. Nick, England are bottom of the table at the moment, just one win from their five matches. Everything just seems to be going horribly wrong for the team. What do you make of it, or what do you think the biggest problem's been so far?
It's just not played very well. But I don't think there's any massive smoking gun, to be honest. I think it is a great team coming to the end of its natural cycle, that hasn't played very much ODI cricket in the last 4 years and probably therefore hasn't had much opportunity to glean, I guess, where some of these guys are still at in the format. I think it's quite telling. The bloke who's played the most ODIs in the last 4 years is the one who's been He's the one who's left out the squad at the last minute, Jason Roy, and that he's the one who, I guess, through being available for those games and through being injured and picking up his back spasms and stuff like that, people become aware. I guess people have opened their eyes, become aware to that fallibility in a way that perhaps hasn't been seen with the guys who have been rested for these games because they've played so much Test cricket and T20 cricket and franchise cricket in the meantime. So we're sort of realizing in real time that a couple of these guys, I don't think it's that many of them, perhaps it's one tournament too far, but in stuff I thought Nasser Hussain, as he tends to do, nailed it last after the Sri Lanka game. There are seven or eight blokes in the squad who put in England's all-time best white ball 11. I don't think they've picked the wrong guys. I don't think there's anyone at home. I would have taken Jason Roy, and I've said that all along, but apart from Roy and the likes of Jofra Archer if he was fit. Apart from those two, you would struggle to say that England are losing because player X or player Y aren't playing. And frankly, I don't think the argument that they're not playing the One Day Cup holds much water either. They didn't play much in the One Day Cup beforehand, and nor does Quinton de Kock play in South Africa's domestic comp, or the Indian lads, or the Afghan guys, or frankly, most of these players. Just the way the schedule works these days, that if something has to give, it tends to be that domestically, and it sounds silly to say, but to make it that simple, they've got a lot of guys out on nick at the same time, which is quite rare, and perhaps there is something underlying within the camp that we don't know about, or that has led to this. I think the amount of travelling that takes place in India makes it quite difficult for guys to hit their way back into form, or even to just rest by a pool for a couple of days and get the body going again and relax properly. And there's a lot of If your bowler is struggling for rhythm, then you're hopping on a flight the next day, and particularly with England playing in nine different venues in nine different cities, that can't be easy. But they have just not played well, and whether that's Jos Buttler or Johnny Bairstow or Chris Wokes, and it's no coincidence the game we're watching right now is England have got the most control they've had in any game so far because Chris Wokes has bowled really nicely, and Wokes has been the metronome for 6, 7 years, really, now for 8 years in that white ball side since 2015. When he bowls well, when he plays well, England play well. When he doesn't give them the control up front, they lose the power play. And if you lose the power plays convincingly, as England have lost these power plays, tend not to win very often. But it's not just Wokes the bowler. What is it, two half-centuries the last two games? Is that right? Just one, wasn't it? Just Hybrid. They got 340 against Bangladesh, who've been pretty, frankly, have been pretty dismal themselves. But even then, England were 290 for two and fell away quite dramatically. So it's just not clicked for whatever reason. It's been very odd to watch.
Nick mentioned the power play there, particularly Ayush. I mean, missing Jofra Archer is obviously going to be a big miss. Chris Wokes has been struggling as well. But one of the big points in the selection was the number of new ball bowlers England seemed to pick, and it hasn't really worked. Do you think that this was an error at the beginning, and they maybe needed to balance their squad and bring someone like a Brydon Carse who can bowl through the middle overs, or try Gus Atkinson a bit earlier on, as he was seemed to be one of their better bowlers in the one game he's played so far?
I agree with that. I mean, absolutely spot on from Nick, first of all, kind of summarizing that what has been the problem with this team. I was always in favor, Toby, that of Gus Atkinson coming into the team a lot earlier than he did. I really wanted to see England unleash him. I wouldn't say right from the start. I would understand why they wouldn't do that. But, you know, getting him relatively earlier than they did. But I get where they're coming from as well. You know, guys like Atkinson and Ryan Gus, not that experienced, especially at this level, at the World Cup stage. So I get where they were coming from a little bit. Yes, they were, you know, the guys that could add variety to that pace bowling attack, like you mentioned. And eventually all we saw was just so many new ball bowlers, so many bowlers, you know, better equipped with bowling up front over there. So, yeah, I would have liked to see Gus Atkinson, especially earlier, but somewhere with the kind of team they have, personally, I saw where they were coming from. It's just, again, like Nick mentioned very rightly, they've just not been firing. It's such a big surprise because, I mean, you know, we both predicted England would go on to lift the title before the tournament started. And it would have been great to see them continue that, you know, that fearless kind of attitude that they have and go ahead. But I don't know, is it just the conditions, is it the travel? I don't know what has been the problem mainly.
Things I not say they've not made a fair few baffling decisions along the way. England's whole philosophy for 8 years has been batting as deep as they possibly can, all rounders doing the job with bat and ball means you can bat, means you can have Rashid 10, Wood 11, and really you can bat all the way down, which allows the guys at the top to go harder and harder. The team they're putting in South Africa was absolutely mental. As far from their plan as they've gone possibly since 2015, you know, without putting too much thought into it. I can't think of another time they've gone so far away from their agreed approach. You know, David Willey at 7, that doesn't allow the top 6 to go hard. If you've got Willey 7, I can't remember who came in at 8, but the teams that have a top 6 and the bottom 5, India probably the most starkly, have such a quality controlled top 6, and they don't go as hard as England do from the outset. They've got all format blokes in the top 5 who can manage any situation. England have got someone like Josh Butler at 5 who you don't really want to see in the 10th over. Liam Livingston at 6, certainly don't want to see him in the 10th over. You certainly don't want to see David Willey in the 11th over. You know, but that game was emblematic of how little clarity they've had. And as I say, whether that's because they're not used to playing this badly, or because they've not had enough one-day cricket the last 4 years, or whether losing Reece Topley threw things up in the air. The real elephant in the room is Ben Stokes. Stokes coming in as this specialist batter at the last minute was meant to solve loads of issues. Ultimately, what Stokes coming in does, and actually Stokes coming in doesn't cause issues because they're always going to be picking a specialist batter in that position, whether it was Brooke or Roy or whoever, or Milan, the 3 and Roy and Best at the top, whatever they're going to do. Stokes not being able to bowl is the issue, because it means that you're then having these discussions about whether you can afford to pick Gus Atkinson and Reece Topley because it lengthens your tail. That is why you end up with David Willey at 7. If Stokes is fit to bowl, then one of Willey or Atkinson doesn't play that game against Africa at all in the first place, because then that allows you to pick Brooke, and that allows you then to have Livingston at 7. Well, no, Livingston didn't play, so you've got Brooke at 7, for example. And then suddenly your whole depth issues disappear and you've got this perfectly balanced side. India's seeing it right now with Hardik injured. You go from having a side that's got Hardik at 7, Jadeja 8, to a side that's got Bumrah or Shami cards coming at 8. That's your top 6, bottom 5 kind of thing that is so risky, and that's when you lose your top order cheaply, it's very hard to win a game from there. But England just, and of course, and that's been heightened by how bad the all-rounders have been. No, not just Wokes, that's Wokes, Curran, Livingston, Moeen. None of them have had any impact with bat or ball. So you end up in this position where you're worried, end up in this position where you look both light on batting and light on bowling, which is quite an effort, but speaks to how out of nick these guys have been. And, you know, we talk about the middle overs, that they do have a middle over seam, and Mark Wood, that is his job, but he's been pumped, because one of the great misnomers of playing cricket in the subcontinent is that you just bowl spin, then, you know, if you bowl spin, you've got somebody who bowls quick, you're sorted. You still need to bowl well. If you bowl 90 mile an hour and you're bowling wide off stump, it just goes off the bat harder and further, which is what they saw against Klassen, against Marker, and whoever it was that was out there, Klassen. You know, they've just not bowled well. So I think if you had Woodford firing all the time, I think Rashid has bowled really well. And actually, the reason I'd have gone possibly even more round heavy against Africa, is that faced with a with what you know will be a high scoring game at the Wankhede, why pick another bowler? You know you're going to be chasing 300s, whether you've got your best attack or a less good attack. But if you're going to be chasing 300, you better have the batters to go and chase it. So chasing 400 with what they thought was a better attack, stronger attack for those conditions against that team, you end up chasing more runs with fewer batters on a deck and an outfield that was always going to mean that you're going to chase runs in the first place. Yeah, they've not played well, but they've also not thought very well. And a lot of criticism, I mean, I think there's been a lot of criticism of Josh Butler, which I sort of get because he's the captain of the team. But they thought very well this time 12 months ago, and he won, and they won a T20 World Cup. Frankly, in large part due to his captaincy. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, the captain's a rubbish captain. But they've made a lot of decisions. They've got a lot of things wrong. You know, whether that was the toss against South Africa, the toss against Afghanistan, the team against South Africa. It's been extremely uncharacteristic, and not just how poorly they've played, but how poorly thought out a lot of this has been.
Another thing that I thought was slightly weird with their squad selection and their thought process was the spin options. They had sort of more frontline spin options playing in England in 2019 with Liam Dawson in the squad than they do now with Livingston and Ali, both as sort of part-timers.
I wonder whether, as I say, part of that, it goes back to the lack of 50-over cricket they've played as a team, not domestically, but internationally. And I give back a good friend of mine, Cam Ponsby, you know, the cricket journalist, tweeted this, and it's a very good point, a very fair point, that the issue with not playing any game doesn't give guys the chance to lose their spot. If you're first choice in 2019 and you're only really playing one in every three between then and 2023, then it's hard to say, oh, yeah, actually, is Moeen still the guy? Is Dawson the guy now? And I guess that is where the domestic comp comes in. But I think the other thing on the back of that as well is that I get the sense they might have overestimated the amount how much Dew would be involved in this tournament and how much of an impact that would have, and in fact that would play, which I think is why they've been keen to have one frontline spinner in Rashid and then muddle through with Livingston and Moeen, who, if they're batting well enough, you know, the bowling sort of takes care of itself. If they need to get through 10 overs between them with Joe Root as well, that should be ample. And I don't think, you know, how many teams, I can't think of many games at all where spin has, not where spin has won the game, but where spin has won the game because it's been a raging turn. Afghanistan beat England because England played their spinners very poorly. They bowled very well, but it wasn't turning a foot. You know, it was not impossible to bat on. You know, and this is quite early on in Indian summer as well. So you're not looking at, you know, you're not looking at pitches that are ragging and that are, you know, the guys are bowling. That sure, the top couple of wicket-takers are spinners in the tournament, Zampa and Santner. But Santner, you wouldn't say Santner's a big spinner of it. And you'd say that Zampa is a very, very clever spinner. But I don't think if you pick Liam Dawson, he'd have 14 wickets and England would be flying. You know, I don't think he's that much. I think he's that much better or worse spinner than Moeen. Like, I think it's easy to get caught up in the spin thing because it's a subcontinent World Cup, but it's not that extreme level. If you know what I mean? This isn't. They're not playing fifth day Gaul pitches. Thank God, it'll be the worst tournament ever. But yeah, like even India. I mean, India definitely the best example. Has Ashwin played?
He's just played, I think, a game.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's your answer, isn't it? Like, as a general rule, just follow what India are doing. You know, with the balance of their team, they know what they're doing. They know the grounds, but anyone else, they play at these places all the time. If you're picking Shardul Thakur ahead of Ravi Ashwin, it's because you don't think spin is going to win you a game. Although that said, I'd pick Ashwin every day of the week in any conditions.
Ayush, Nick also mentioned there the sort of the middle overs for England have been a big issue. Mark Wood in particular has been hit around a lot. He's had a sort of slightly better last game or two, but has been going at tens fairly consistently throughout. Do you think that the loss of Liam Plunkett was a huge issue from 2019? And they never really replaced him. They just kind of assumed that Mark Wood would be the one to sort of continue through.
Yeah, I do. Missing his experience mainly, I think 2019, the biggest thing was his experience. He just knew how to get those wickets in the middle overs. You need someone like that. Again, going back to the example of India as well. It's led by the spinners in the middle overs, Kuldeep, Jadeja, guys like that. But whenever Shardul plays, he gets those wickets. England have really missed that. Even going back to the game against South Africa, I think that was the real, I think, dent in their confidence and morale.
Losing that way while boiling themselves to death for 4 hours. I mean, it's all about decisions. That was that was the one, wasn't it? Like, we're going to win the toss and elect to fry while and get pumped in the process. The only other thing I'd say on the middle overs, what game we're watching now sums this up really. If you take early wickets, you control the middle overs. If you get pumped in the power play, you've got no control going to middle overs, and suddenly you're on the back. You know, it's very difficult to, once the ball stops swinging, once the ball gets old, once you've got four men out, it's pretty difficult to take wickets. But if you bollock a drain in the power play, which England have done for what until today, essentially, you're sort of hiding to nothing. You know, I think England thought that Sam Curran and Liam Livingstone would help fill the void of, because they're really the two bowlers who've come in since 2019 into this side. You know, obviously Gus more recently, but what he played three ODIs before this World Cup started. I haven't played an ODI at all until August. So really, the long-term planning was subcontinent World Cup, Curran, Livingstone, bit of part-time spin, and someone who bowls pretty handy medium pace and has the cutters and stuff. It made sense. And of course, the other one they lost in the middle overs is Stokes. As we're seeing here with David Willey bowling in a period of play that doesn't normally bowl in 30-odd overs in. You can do that when you've got the oppo four down or three down 10 in 15 overs, because you are controlling the game. If your new ball bowlers bowl as they have done, even the Afghanistan game, if Raminullah can give you an 80-run head start, sort of doesn't matter how you bowl in the middle overs. You thought yesterday's game, actually, Australia New Zealand was a really good example. Australia won that power play so comprehensively that they could then balls up, frankly, 80% of the remainder of their innings and still get 380. You know, 120 for none after 10 overs. And then you end up with this weird period where Marsh is struggling, and then you've got Smith and Labuschagne, whose game isn't to, keep the attack going. Suddenly you're 270 for five with 10 overs to go. And for New Zealand, that's a massive recovery. But you're still on course to get 380 if you use the last 10 overs well, because you won the power play that comprehensively. And sure, England haven't lost a power play to quite that degree. But, even when they nicked off de Kock in the first over of the South Africa game, it was still 64 after 10 overs. You've not really made any inroads. And if you're then 120 for one, it's very hard to restrict, whether you've got Liam Plunkett there or not. So as much of Plunkett as a loss, he's a bigger loss because of how poorly they bowl up front.
How much of a beneficial effect on the squad do you think Jofra Archer would have had?
Well, Jofra makes any team better, doesn't he? Because he's Jofra Archer. But, with the greatest will in the world, if your plan was to have Jofra Archer fit, then your plan's not been thought through very well. It's through no fault of his own, and no one wants to be fit more than Jofra wants to be fit, but he's not been fit for 2 years. Let's face it, 3 years consistently. So it's lovely to want everything to come together, and it did come together in 2019. But even then, they faced, Jason Roy got injured and did his hamstring, and they struggled for a couple of games. See, this is why I'd have brought Roy to the tournament, because England are a better ODI team with Jason Roy in it, and they have been since 2015. Like, it's not the runs he scores, it's the way he scores them. He whacks good bowlers, he whacks good bowling. Bairstow and Roy had an aura that Milan and Bairstow don't have, because partly because they're a new pairing, partly because Milan's got a way of going about his work, which works. But second over the world, so first over the World Cup, England took 12 off it, hit the second ball of the World Cup for six. Second over the World Cup was a maiden. That I can guarantee that just would not have happened 4 years ago. And that's not a criticism of Milan, because it's the way he plays. He's England's top run scorer, and he's got an extraordinary record in ODI cricket. But so much of England was built on the back of just knocking oppositions off their length straight away and having them off the back foot, on the back foot straight away. The way they've gone about this World Cup, if you bowl straight at Milan, it doesn't really get after you. Even the Sri Lanka game, the last defeat, it's very easy to say that England were going really well at 45 for none. They were. But Sri Lanka bowled about as badly as you could possibly bowl with them as a pair for the first six overs. But wide arm volleys at Milan, he'll whack you. But I think Roy looked to whack you whatever you bowled. That's it. There's nothing to say that he'd have done the same this time around. There was no evidence for it. He had a terrible 100. Didn't have a great 100. He's obviously had his back injury, missed the New Zealand series. I completely get why he's not there. But, and this isn't being wise after the event. As at the time, England are a better team with Jason Roy in it. And I think they're also a more fun team with Jason Roy in it. That's not to say that's why they're winning or losing. But yeah, but it takes you back to the Archer thing, which is like, England just have not, if their answer was Archer will be fit, that sort of sums up where their preparation has been at for this. Because there's no evidence of that in the last 3 years to suggest that even if he had been fit, it would have been negligent to expect them to play nine games in a row, once the tournament started. Yeah, they'd be a better team for him being there because he is Jofra Archer. But they won a T20 World Cup last year without him, didn't they? They can win without him. The trouble they've had is that the lads they've got bowled, they've just not bowled very well. And often in the past, England's batting got themselves out of trouble. But they've not bowled, but they've not batted very well, or you know, they've not batted well enough to save the bowling. You know, you go back to the first game, 280 was about 100 under par. So however badly they bowled, your bowlers have a lot more confidence defending 380 than they do defending 280. That's any level of cricket, you know, whether you're playing in a World Cup or, you know, second level cricket on a Saturday.
And I think they were also let down by, you know, how Sam Curran and Mark Wood have gone about this World Cup, because there was a lot of dependence on them, especially given among this bowling lineup. Those are the guys who've bowled the most in the IPL as well. If you see recent seasons, Sam Curran also, I think he did so well with Punjab, and then Mark Wood this season especially had a pretty decent, I would say. He had his moments in this IPL, the last IPL, but he was good. Started with a fifer, and whenever he played, he did well. So there was a lot on reliance, given that these two have bowled a lot in these Indian conditions, but again, just didn't click.
One thing that's been thrown around quite a lot with problems with this one-day side, Nick, is the 100. Obviously, that's quite critical of this format, and Joe Root's come out against that idea and says that actually the 100's not necessarily the problem. It's maybe the lack of domestic cricket, which we've kind of talked about as well. But for me, the biggest problem really is that England's sort of first 11 side haven't really played together in this last 4 years.
Yeah, that's the main problem. And I honestly, that's not a 100 issue. Like, it's a global schedule issue. You know, we had a T20 World Cup in 2021. We had a T20 World Cup in 2022. You know, obviously, 2020 was COVID year. 2019 was the year of World Cup. 2020 was meant to be the T20 World Cup, then got pushed back here by COVID. So they wanted to play more 50 over cricket, they could find time to play more 50 over cricket. The thing of 100 means you lose a month of international white ball cricket, because you could not possibly have 100 being played at the same time as the England white ball team, because you'd lose all the best players. Not quite the same with the test side, but certainly one day wise. So you say, sure, you lose August. But the issue is wider than that. It's frankly just the global schedule. If you've got two T20 World Cups 2 years in a row, you're forced to prepare for those. Because if you played 50 over cricket the whole way through 2022, we have the same argument as we're having now if England went and bombed the T20 World Cup last year. So you can't have that both ways. England also played more Test cricket than anyone else because it sells in the UK, because it is still the purest format, the best format. But abroad, there's not much appeal for a big 50 over series. Frankly, the shambolic organisation of this World Cup meant that when they first planned the Ireland series, it wasn't meant to be England's B team, you know. But but the way this World Cup was organised, you know, to use the term very loosely, you know, I can't recall a sports tournament being set up worse than this. You know, ticket sales, dates being changed, schedules being changed, all that stuff. So that was three ODIs that they could have. I mean, it rained for one half of them, but. But yeah, they've not played enough for years. So part of that is sort of the schedule's fault. Well, fault is the reality of the schedule, and the reality as well of franchise cricket and the changing landscape of the game. And part of it's just because of where the format sits and people's priorities.
Yeah, it does seem to be getting pushed further and further to the edge, and
which is a shame, because it's genuinely a really good format, and it didn't help that there were 25 crap games in a row to start this tournament. You know, it took Pakistan and South Africa to produce a good finish. And then we got two in 2 days. And if we're lucky, you know, we might even get three in a row today. But that's not true, because we had another game because Bangladesh got rolled by the Netherlands. It's a brilliant format when it's played well by both teams. There are mitigating factors to that. You know, until the South Africa game, the England South Africa game, when you get pumped to 400 in that heat, you see it so often that a team goes big and the game is done within 35 overs. Because if you've been in that heat for as long as England were that day. I honestly thought that was the most impressive thing about yesterday, the Australia game. It's so easy to start well on those chases and to fall away. You know, and maybe that is a positive product to T20 cricket or 50 over cricket, which is if you're batting first and you go and you know you real and you're going well, you can go so big that it can just demoralise sides. And if you know you've got to go eight from the start, if you lose three early wickets, the game's done. So, you know, that's where we've seen a couple of these complete no contest games come from. I think also we're just seeing more and more the sides are pretty evenly matched playing against each other now. And, you know, maybe that's complete rubbish, but in my head, it sort of feels like we watched a lot of games between teams that you always sort of expected one side to win from the outset. Whereas actually, last 3 days, Pakistan, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Netherlands, Bangladesh, England, India. At the start of the tournament, you'd have said these are four games where you're genuinely not, you're not entirely sure where it's going to go. You know, you didn't know then that England and Pakistan would bomb their head out of it and lose four in a row. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. And maybe it's such a long tournament that you sort of forget. So I'm probably forgetting half the games that have been played. It does feel like it started years ago.
It really does. I mean, I think the talk for the next tournament's already to change it a little bit into two groups of seven, I think it is at the moment.
Look, if you can play as badly as England have played and not yet be out, that is a bad format. Fact. Like, it is the hill I will die on. And we all know why it's like this. Because if you get the top 10 teams in the world playing nine games each and the broadcast money can sell for more, it's pretty basic. Like, you know, and sure there'll be people who say to you, this is a great format because it gets everyone playing everyone, you get an accurate result at the end of it. Maybe it is, but have this over a year. Call it the ODI Championship. Give some context to it to all. Everyone, you know, it's a 10-team league. Everyone play, or to call it have a 12-team league and have Ireland and the West Indies. We'll make it 15-team, or 14 teams, and have Zimbabwe involved and Scotland and a lot of other very decent sides who would have done, as you know, who frankly would have been similarly competitive to the Netherlands and England. This can exist. Give the whole thing context. Play for a trophy. Make it a year-long thing where everyone plays everyone. So I think rugby are doing similar, aren't they? They're sort of losing the traditional test tours, as it were, and replacing it with a championship where a 10-team championship where everyone plays everyone in designated areas. So you retain the autumn series, the spring series, but you play a different team each time. I think that'd be fantastic. It gives context to it. I can see why it won't happen, but it is just so long. And sure, the Rugby World Cup took a month and a bit, but those guys have a deserved week off. But that format of watching a game a day, groups, competitive quarterfinals are brilliant. You know, at the moment, we know that India are going to get to the semi-finals, no matter what they do for the next 2 weeks. Then they'll get to the semi-finals, probably having won every game, possibly having won every game. And we'll get to the semi-final, and if they start like they did today against England, but knowing that if they lose, they're out. If they're 4-2-3, and then they lose row and they're 40-4, that's the World Cup done. And we've had this nonsense month of everyone playing everyone. You know, these 2 weeks of dead rubbers where no one's playing for anything. We all sort of know what's going to happen, sort of know where everyone stands. And then we'll get these semi-finals, and four teams, two of whom at least, will be fairly, not undercooked, but won't have played for anything for 2 weeks. It ironically, it really helped England in 2019, because they had to win their last three to get to the semis. But we'll get this position where we know that India are going to be semi-finalists already, and we have done for a week. If India lose a bad toss in the first game they've played for 3 weeks that matters, they could be out of their home World Cup. Whereas if you have a World Cup where you've got groups of four, and sure, like everyone understands that the ICC, the broadcasters, want India to play Pakistan, that, you know, they've fudged it for years to make sure they're in the same groups. Put them in the same group. You know, do what you've got to do. Have this great game that doesn't get played off enough. And then at the end of the group stage, and you go to quarterfinal and a semi-final and a final. And it might not last long. It might not make you as much money. But as a competition, it is just better. Because what we've got now is sort of working, because the Netherlands have been great and have won games. We've had upsets and we've had teams that people don't follow the game every day. You know, Afghanistan wasn't as big an upset as people make out. They're a very talented team with a lot of guys who play franchise cricket and a lot of guys who are very well suited to these conditions. But Afghanistan beating England is a surprise to people. It should make, you know, you shouldn't need England to stink the place out for it to be a good tournament.
I think that actually setting up the Cricket World Cup exactly like the Rugby World Cup could make it very interesting, obviously without the week breaks in the middle. But having four groups of five kind of means that the groups are big enough that losing one game or one upset won't destroy a whole tournament. But if you play like England do, they'll go out winless in the group stages, losing to Namibia and sort of the sort of associate nations.
It's funny, the Netherlands said before the tournament they didn't want to be considered an associate nation. And I understand why, because their view is it puts a ceiling on what they can achieve, because it gives them it ties them to a tag. And that's a great mindset to come out of, because they're competing with nine sides with big, you know, better resource and everything. And But the reality is, they are an association. What they've done is brilliant. And I used to work in associate cricket, so I've got an enormous amount of time for them and all the other associations, because I cannot tell you how little they've got to work with versus everyone else. You know, they were begging for ODIs after they qualified for this and couldn't get any. Cricket is the only tournament in the world that is shrinking its own World Cup. You know, football's going from 32 to 48. You know, whatever the arguments are for and against, it is a World Cup, and if the World Cup should represent the world. So on that pretty basic level, I'm not against that. It will make it very long, and there'll be some one-sided games, but there already are, and it already is quite long. But it's a World Cup. You know, it's that Rugby World Cup's getting bigger, whereas England are shrinking it more and more, to the point that we've got a World Cup without the West Indies at the moment, because they had it's been a pretty poor 4 years. You know, and it is, you're right, it is growing, and it's, I think it's going to 14 teams in 2027. But it is worth remembering that it has shrunk since 2007, because there were too many upsets for the ICC's liking. Ireland beat Pakistan, Bangladesh beat Pakistan.
They beat India in 2007, yeah.
I think I'm right saying this. I think what happened was that because of the upsets, India didn't play Pakistan, which takes away that huge game for the broadcasters, but also for the fans. You know, it is the most watched game of cricket in the world. And it's no coincidence that since then, we've had this situation where it's almost been, you know, the great irony of England blowing it like they have done this World Cup is that this tournament is set up to minimise the jeopardy for the good side, you know, for the sides that people expect to, for the big sides, basically. In an ideal world, the ICC, England, Australia, India, Pakistan are the semi-finalists, because they are big markets, and they're your money makers, really. It's no coincidence it's gone that way since 2007, when we had a World Cup that wasn't, you know, that turned out different results and different storylines and prevented some of those things from happening. But yeah, like I said, it's great because you're watching a month of very good cricket, very good cricketers, and it's lovely having a game a day. You know, like we all love a football World Cup where you can lock in on your sofa for three games of football. You know, no one gives a shit about Poland v Qatar, but we're all going to watch it because it's the World Cup. Like, and that's great. And frankly, that applies to the Netherlands v Bangladesh yesterday, doesn't it? Like, there'll be people who, as a general rule, would not care, but will sit there and watch it because it's a World Cup. But you can't have too much of a good thing. You know, we've got a Champions Trophy in 2025, which is essentially the same thing, isn't it? The top eight teams of the world. The World Cup is for the world, so invite the world. Otherwise, this is just an extended Champions Trophy.
Yeah, although we haven't seen many tight matches until the last couple, we've seen a lot of upsets, and it really has shown the growth of the smaller nations, the associate nations like Netherlands, and also the old associate nations such as Afghanistan, who are new test sides. Do you think that this is just another reason why they need more teams in this World Cup and to try and change the format and make it a World Cup, as Nick's been saying?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it does come down to, right? Like Nick said, that it's the World Cup and why the world? And it has to be that way. I mean, like the ICC is trying to do that through the 20-over format, as we've been seeing. The next year's World Cup is going to be 20 teams again, the one in the Caribbean and the USA. But yeah, it's the World Cup has to have these teams and get these associate nations to play a lot more cricket here as well. It just makes it it's very exciting, doesn't it? The upsets that we've seen, the kind of cricket that the Netherlands have been playing on and off. Yeah, it's not been consistent, but
and crucially, no one else will be consistent either.
Exactly.
You won't see more one-sided game at a World Cup for a while than South Africa, England. No matter who you invite, you know, no matter who qualifies, and you know, and it's funny because if that had been Oman losing by 200 runs to South Africa, we'd no doubt have people saying, oh, you know, this isn't what a World Cup should look like. But England going to stink the place out in that game, and we have none of that, do we? Like it's all built on snobbery. Like, you know, it still exists in the T20 World Cup. The first week of the T20 World Cup is still called the qualifying round. When the reality is that, you know, these countries, the associate nations qualified for the World Cup the previous year, and yet you get to this first round of the World Cup, that's still called the qualifying round. It's part of the World Cup. There's a good piece by Phil Walker of Wisden earlier in the week. He sort of said that we're obviously around the talk about the ICC and the future of the world of this World Cup. He said, what other sports midway through its own World Cup would be sat there preparing for meetings about whether this should happen again? It's a great game. It's just got this like fetish for harming itself. It's maddening. You know, even today, George Bell has been it's reporting that 2025 Champions Trophy is going to feature only the two, only the top eight teams in this World Cup. But most of the teams didn't know that until today. It is not a game that helps itself a lot of the time. You only have to look at Game One, Ahmedabad, 130,000 seater stadium. If you're gonna have your opening game of a World Cup in 130,000 seater stadium, you've got to sell those tickets. And if you've got to sell those tickets, put India there, you know. Or and frankly, sell tickets in advance. Sell them at affordable prices. Make it easy for people to get into the ground. Don't have a situation where they get with a World Cup start with a World Cup of this format that is. I don't want to call it struggling. I think it's a brilliant format, but you know, this World Cup, this format that needs a leg up and a bit of help. Help it. Don't have your you know don't have the World Cup start in front of you know however many hundred people were in that ground. It doesn't help anyone. There's no common sense. And the crowds have picked up, and that is true. And they've been brilliant when India have been playing, you know, as you'd hope and as you'd expect. But there's still far too many stories of how complex it's been for supporters to get to the grounds if they wanted to, but also how many people haven't been able to travel because of how late the schedule came out, and how many changes that, and the changes that were to the schedule once the schedule even came out. So England, for example, tend to be the biggest, you know, have a pretty decent travelling following wherever they go. Having England fly to nine different venues doesn't make it very difficult for a bunch of travelling supporters, and it doesn't, you know, and as great as it was for India Pakistan to break all these streaming records, you know, that is doesn't help the notion that no one's really thought about the actual paying fans. And that's not just this World Cup. That is very much a general, you know, sporting thing rather than a cricket thing. But that could be an amazing spectacle. First game of World Cup, 130,000 seat stadium. How can we get 130,000 people into that stadium? That's got to be the thought process. Thought process can't just be World Cup starts today, let's go. Because if there were, you know, unless everyone came dressed in like orange seats, there were not 130. There were not 30,000 people then, let alone 130,000 people.
Your colleague George De Bell also ran an article last week about the sort of future of cricket, and you've been mentioning it there a little bit. It seems a bit weird that considering the 2027 World Cup has pretty much been sorted already and they already know the format, that they are still talking about whether or not it might go ahead. Do you think that there is any chance of it all being scrapped?
No, I think it'll go ahead. It'll go ahead. It's the format in which it goes ahead. Whether that means, I don't actually know what that means, what it's worth, but there will be, you're right, there are more World Cups, the broadcast schedule. So they will 100% take place. It's whether it happens in the format that we've seen this one. It's whether it's 50 overs. You know, it won't be 20 overs, but you know, these used to be 60 overs, these World Cups. I would be perfectly happy and frankly in favour of a 40 over World Cup. 40 over is, I think 40 over cricket is a brilliant format. I love it. I think it's good. I think it's fun. It's a slightly shorter day, and it's a little. It'd be interesting. I think it's a little bit closer to T20 cricket. And if you have a situation where teams aren't playing as many 50-over internationals or domestically, whatever, then having a format that is a little bit more recognisable to the players who are playing it, then that can only help. You know, 40-over was the, you know, the CB40 was a great competition here, domestic cricket for a while. I don't want to call that boring bit, but that bit in the middle is a bit shorter. I think it'd be really interesting. I'd say I've got no. I say with no authority, I don't know it's going to be like that, but I wouldn't be against it. But I wouldn't be against doing 50 overs because I think if you do this right, it's a really good tournament. And actually, for what it's worth, the Rugby World Cup was a bit like this because, not to say it was very good, you do also have days when, you know, New Zealand play Uruguay, and you know, you've got to be a real purist to tune in and think it's going to be worth watching. But the knockout stages of that tournament were genuinely, and I don't watch any rugby for 4 years between World Cups. But that was brilliant sport because of stuff riding on it. So I've got no doubt the back end of this tournament will be fantastic because they always are. You know, think of the semi-finals of the last World Cup. I've never seen an England sports team play better than they did against Australia at Edgbaston. And I don't think I've seen many better 50, more dramatic 50 over games than the 2 day game between India and New Zealand. But then obviously the final was the final, and everyone talks about that. But actually, if you think back to the last bit of that comp, even going back to when England needed to win those games in the group stage, when it matters, when there is stuff riding on it, when there's jeopardy, World Cups are fantastic, fantastic things, which is why, going back to what we were saying before, this could be so much better than it is. So you've got all these games that are playing out for little, you know, with little jeopardy on them, with little, you know, fact is, if England had beaten Afghanistan, if England had beaten Sri Lanka, if everything went by the rankings, you'd have a pretty dull group stage. Thankfully, sport's not just played through the ICC rankings, but you could make this so much better with a bit more context on every game. By, as I said right at the start of this, if you lose four games in a row, it's mental that you can still win the World Cup. If England were to win this World Cup, they'd have lost to two-fifths of the team at the tournament. Two-fifths of the teams at the tournament. Anyone else in any other sport, if you told them that, I'd just think your sport was insane.
It is mental. Yeah, as you say, no other sport is like that. Are you looking forward to the future, particularly for England? What do you think that they'll be able to do over the next sort of 4 years, the next cycle? And what do you think that they'll have learned most from their failures this time around?
Changes are coming, aren't they? I mean, it's also the stuff that we spoke about the last time with the England team, everyone above 30 years of age in that last game that they took the field for. So, of course, changes are going to be coming. I think, looking at the next 4 years, I'm not sure. This problem is going to be there where they are not going to play a lot of ODI cricket, aren't they? What happened from 2019 to until now, I think that's going to happen again. I don't think that England are really going to be like, wow, okay, 2023 in India was an absolute disaster. We've got to now put more focus on the ODI structure, on that 50-over structure, have more games in between the World Cup. Maybe they'll try to do a little bit more than they did in the build-up.
Interestingly, I think that's the one thing England will do. I don't know, they won't change the domestic structure for this, but I do think there'll be a bit of sort of tacit admission that they got the international schedule wrong. I don't think they've, you know, like, because they really do pride themselves on how good they are at this. Like, they've been a brilliant, brilliant white ball team. And it's a real shame that, like, I think genuinely the sad thing is that they've been a bit of a laughing stock here, because they've been an amazing white ball team for 8 years. And they've had, frankly, a rubbish few weeks. Like, in the context of 8 years, they've set and broke their own world record three times for the highest score in ODI cricket. You know, no one else has got near them. I think five of the eight 400-plus scores that have come since 2015 have been by England. Like, they've been brilliant, and they've had a pretty shoddy couple of weeks. That shouldn't take away from what, like, the legacy of this team should not be this. It should be how fantastically good they became from a pretty abject base, and, you know, the changes they made and the things they did to get to this point. They've been fantastic. There's been a lot of people say, a lot of guys in the camp have said, we genuinely don't know what's happened. But there have also been guys in that camp who've said it would have been useful to play a bit more ODI cricket. They played three random T20s before they played three ODIs against New Zealand. There's no reason why those shouldn't have been six ODIs. Would have helped both teams. World Cup coming up. Play six ODIs. I think there probably was some complacency that, maybe not complacency, I think they've possibly realised through this tournament that there maybe is a bit more of a difference between formats than they believed. That being brilliant 20-over cricketers isn't enough on its own. You know, that obviously helps, but you do still need that time to get back into the rhythm of 50-over cricket. So actually, I think they won't change things structurally. I really don't think they should, because I don't think this is not a team that's lost because of structure. It's a team that's lost because they played pretty poorly. Like, even without the ODIs this summer, they should have played better than they have done. But I do think going forward, we might see a couple more. I do think they'll play a few more, because they have looked an awful lot like they've just phoned this in and hoped it'd be all right on the night. It's funny, like, in 2015, when they sacked Cook on the eve of the tournament as captain and gave it to Morgan, that was phoned in. You know, let's see how it goes. You know, they were, you know, Gary Balance at number three. Like that was not a well thought through side at all. Whereas I suspect there's a bit of shame that the perception they've given off is that they don't care about these things, because they really, you know, between Morgan and Butler, who've shared this 4 year period, you know, they've hired Matthew Mott as a white ball head coach. So they care and they're very, very good at it. And I think they'll go away from this. And the one thing they might do is go, you know, we could have helped them a bit more with preparation.
Yeah, and I'd love to see them play more ODIs.
They might have to find some teams to play, but
and, you know, like you mentioned, that they put in those three T20s along with those three ODIs. It's so close to the World Cup. You saw that in India and the West Indies as well. They're playing three ODIs, but they're playing five T20s in just a few months, couple of months away from the World Cup. Yeah, I know they wanted to get those couple of games in Florida as well. All of that was part of it. But 3 months away from the World Cup, you're playing three ODIs and you're playing five T20s. And that's where it's going. Is this, even in a World Cup year, they just want to put those T20Is in the middle of wherever they can.
I think we can't forget as well that this sort of the future for this England side is bright as well. I mean, you look at the players who haven't been selected for the squads, the sort of depth they have. I mean, Ben Duckett's been great in this sort of period. Will Jacks is effectively the incumbent T20 opener and has been brilliant as well. I mean, Gus Atkinson bowled fantastically, I thought, in the one game he's played. Brydon Carst gets drafted in and I think could be a star for the future. And I think there is still a lot of hope going forward for this England side. And it's almost now going to depend how can they sort of filter through these youngsters and cycle around to the next tournament in 4 years' time.
Yeah. And I also don't think the changes should be as wholesale as people maybe think they will be. You know, there are a couple of guys who won't make it to next World Cup. So Dan Milan's 36 now, I think. So Milan, you'd think, will probably post final ODI against the Netherlands at the end of this tournament. You know, Mark Wood is 33. You wouldn't think he'd still be, you know, I mean, you wouldn't think it'd be worthwhile to pick him for 4 years in ODI cricket. You know, but a lot of the guys before this World Cup, so they wanted to keep going until 2027. So that, whether that's Bairstow or Stokes or Root, you know, this would be Moeen's last ODI. But bear in mind, they've signed all these guys, re-signed these guys on central contracts. So there's an expectation they'll still be around. Adil Rashid, I doubt, has another World Cup in him, unfortunately. And he'll probably be the one who's toughest to replace. You know, Josh Butler will still be the captain in the next World Cup. Going back to, you know, very probably the first thing we said in this podcast, like, the guys we're listing here are gun white ball players. And a lot of them should retire on their turn. The idea of dropping Josh Butler because he's had a bad World Cup be, you know, criminally insane. Like, and they won't do it. And this is the thing, I think there is still a spine in this side that will be there in 4 years' time. Sam Curran's 4 years further on. You know, you'd like to think his game's developed for, you know, by four more years and he's still involved. Liam Livingstone's still young enough. Whether Livingston is the ODI cricketer that they maybe think he is, I'm not convinced. You know, for his top, he had a bit of luck with injuries. Who knows? You know, Chris Wokes has been his last World Cup. But certainly for, you know, a lot of that top six, like, they're not, it's not like you're going to have Jacks, Crawley, Duckett as your top three, you know, before you know it. So, and obviously Harry Brook's in the squad as well. Harry Brook is the future of it all. So they've got a very big pool of players. I wouldn't discount the guys who have played here.
Quickly, before we finish off this podcast, we'll have a few predictions from you, Nick. Myself and Ayush picked England to win the World Cup before the tournament. We've both changed our tune since, I think, which is fair enough. But who do you think will be the two finalists and who do you think will win that final then? Because the four semi-finalists are fairly obvious now, it looks like.
For no good reason, before the World Cup started, I said Australia would win it. And I don't know. I think that they're a lot like England in that they've come into the tournament completely muddled. That where they're different from England, they've got so many players in Nick. I don't know. I just so I don't have to be really honest and say India. If India don't win it, I think Australia will win it. I think the final will be India v Australia because I suspect it will end up with New Zealand and South Africa in third and fourth. Also South Africa third, New Zealand fourth maybe. And we all know what South Africa are like in the semi-finals. The really interesting thing, and this talk going back to what we say about India batting first here, South Africa love batting first, India love chasing. If either one of those gets asked to do the thing they don't want to do first in a knockout game, see if South Africa get asked to chase in a semi-final, yeah, there wouldn't be many South Africans who are banking on them to win. So, but equally, like Australia, like India, like New Zealand, they've got so many players playing really well right now. But just purely to stick with what I originally said before the tournament, that was on the back of no good thinking. I think Australia, sort of in spite of themselves, could do it. If India don't, India should win and probably will win. But if they were to bat first and be 2 for 3 again, as they were against Australia last time, and then you don't have the brilliant partnership that follows, then, you know, who knows? But it would take something that mental for India not to win it, I think.
Well, I think there's always an opportunity for that, and there's only one way to find out. You see them playing England right now, and they're slightly slipping away from it all. That is all we have time for. And thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, Nick. It's been great to have you on and hear your thoughts. And we'll now see, I guess, whether Australia go on to win it.
No worries at all. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this podcast. It's been another great episode with a great guest. We've got a few articles coming out. I'll be hopefully releasing one on Surrey and their dominance within the county game. Obviously, we'll have our usual Cricket World Cup weekly roundup as well. And I usually be releasing an article about Canadian cricket and their amazing qualification for the T20 World Cup. So make sure you head over to the Sports Gazette website to read all of those articles, as well as many more on many other sports. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back in a couple days for our usual bi-weekly Cricket World Cup coverage. See you then.